This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Straight from the source tonight, breaking news out of Baltimore, where moments ago, the NTSB revealed what's been discovered on a newly obtained data recorder from that doomed cargo ship and 764 tons of hazardous material that was on board when it crashed into that bridge. Also tonight, there is a new litmus test, apparently, to get a job at the new Trump-run Republican National Committee. Wrong answers only, apparently, to this question. Was the 2020 election stolen? It wasn't. But also just in, speaking of the 2020 election, the chief architect of that plot to keep Trump in power is tonight facing a major reckoning. And screens and teens, are smartphones and social media dooming a generation? A guest tonight who has studied the science says yes, and to take them all away until high school. I'm Caitlin Collins, and this is The Source. But we start with the breaking news tonight, as we have just heard from the NTSB with new information on its investigation of the collapse of Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge. Details on the data recorder that was obtained from that 200 million pound cargo ship. Officials say there are 6 hours of recordings, and numerous alarms can be heard as they laid out a timeline of what happened, including this. At 1:26 a.m., the ship's pilot asked nearly for those tugboats that were nearby that had been helping the ship to come back for help, then ordered for the anchor to be dropped because the ship had lost all power by that point. All of this happening just moments before that big crash. We're going to piece together this timeline and what it could mean as this investigation is very much still underway. This comes today as we also learned that in that pitch black water and those dangerously frigid temperatures and high tides with mangled metal all around them, divers late today discovered the two bodies of six of the six missing people. Two of the six of those construction workers who were just doing their jobs on the Key Bridge when this disaster struck. One was identified by a driver's license in his pocket, the other by a single fingerprint. We'll talk more about the victims here in a moment, but on that breaking news, CNN's Pete Muntean joins us, was at that NTSB news conference that just wrapped moments ago. Pete, tell us just the highlights as this investigation is going on. We're getting so many briefings a day. What did they just tell us a moment ago?
National Transportation Safety Board Chair Jennifer Homendy described a sad tale, a boat completely out of control, helpless, with no hope, careening toward the Key Bridge. What is really interesting is that investigators now have the Voyage data recorder, and they were able to give us a TikTok, a blow-by-blow, of what was going on the ship. It left port at about 1:24. It left port earlier than 1:24, about 1:06 in the morning. But at 1:24:59, numerous alarms lit up on the bridge of the ship. That is when the crew on the bridge of the ship called for the tugboats that pulled it out of the secret port there in the port of Baltimore to come back. They reported multiple power failures, and they describe about 4 minutes and 30 seconds of terror. This boat essentially out of control, veering off of the channel in the center of the Patapsco River and toward one of these main pilings of the Key Bridge. What is also really critical here and underscored by NTSB Chair Jennifer Homendy is that this bridge is fracture critical, meaning that of the three spans of the bridge, if one of the pilings comes down, all of the bridge comes down. all of the dominoes comes down. And she says that is especially concerning considering the fact that these bridges are in many places across the country and this ship was 95,000 tons, about the weight of an aircraft carrier, about the length of the Empire State Building. It is also really critical to point out here that the voyage data recorder only recorded very few parameters. It's not like a commercial airliner, she says, with 1,000 different points. They have only about 5 different points of data, including the frantic calls on the bridge of the ship to clear the bridge and to get cars off of it. They say today, according to Governor Westmore, that those actions were heroic.
Pete Muntean, thank you for that update from Baltimore. And we also have here with us tonight the Baltimore Fire Chief, James Wallace. And Chief, it's great to have you here. I know this investigation is very much still underway. And as Pete was saying, there's only so much they can get from that voyage data recorder, talking about how, you know, it's also hard to hear because there are so many sirens and alarms going off. But on the investigation in itself and how it shifted today from this recovery mode to a salvage operation, what does the current state of this investigation look like?
So, and good evening, Caitlin. Thank you for having me. So from a fire department perspective, as you've heard over and you've spoken about, you know, naturally, we're still very cognizant of the fact that there are hazardous materials on board the vessel itself. From a dive team perspective, our team stood down this afternoon after being involved in over a dozen dives just over the past 2 days. We're at a point right now where we believe that we've searched all areas underwater that are safe for divers to search. Now we're moving towards an operation where some salvage is going to need to happen. A lot of underwater debris is going to need to be removed. And the bottom, if you will, of the collapse zone stabilized before divers can reenter the water for any other purposes. So a lot of instability on the crash scene, and something that we're going to have to really be attentive to over the next few days.
What's your sense of, if you have one even at this point, of how long it would take to clear that debris in order for the divers to be able to go back safely to those areas?
My sense, it's going to be a couple of days. We're very fortunate, and Secretary Buttigieg was out there with us yesterday and promised anything that we would need, you know, as well as our governor, Senator Van Hollen, Cardin, and our mayor. And we've not had to ask for anything yet. People are coming to us. Agencies are rallying around us at the state and federal level. And we have all the help that we need right now, and things are moving very quickly. My sense is it's going to take a few days. I think the Corps of Engineers, as well as the Coast Guard and some other structural engineers, need to conduct a good, thorough assessment of the incident scene, both above and below water, but especially up on the bow of the boat, up on the deck. There's a lot of bridge structure up there that remains very unstable. There was damage to the bow of the boat, especially the port side. And as it was earlier stated, there are sea containers up there that are very unstable. So it's going to take a lot of assessment and a lot of meticulous assessment to really get us there.
Chief, let me ask you, though, because you just mentioned one of the biggest headlines out of that press conference, which is the 764 tons of hazardous material that was on that ship. And what I believe the NTSB chair, well, one, she described it as corrosives, flammables, and she said that some of them are breached on the ship, including flammables. And she also described a sheen on the water, seeming to suggest that some of it has made it into the water. Is that what you, do you know how much of that is in the water, if so?
We don't know how much is in the water right now. We are aware that hazardous materials are part of the cargo. And as described, various hazard classes. What we've been able to do, and it's been really, we've relied very heavily on aerial reconnaissance. So the night of the incident, we had Overwatch of Maryland State Police who had infrared capability. And then we've had drones up over top of the site itself. That's the only way we're able to see in. Oftentimes when chemicals release, there are chemical reactions that give off heat. They'll give off a very strong odor. They'll give off a vapor cloud. And it's been that Overwatch piece that's been able to really assure us right now we have no reactions on board. I would also add, it's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, and very dangerous to place people on the bow of that boat right now with the sea containers as tight as they are and the way they've shifted.
Chief James Wallace, thank you for your time tonight.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Also joining us again is maritime expert Sal Mercogliano, who knows ports and container ships inside and out. As we talked about last night, you cover this on your YouTube channel, what's going on with shipping. And Sal, it's great to have you back, because the other big headline out of that press conference that we just got from the NTSB officials was about what was happening with the timeline and what was heard, the alarms before the ship actually hit that bridge, and hearing that pilots called for tugboats to come and assist, but obviously they didn't make it there in time. What was your reaction to that?
Well, I think, you know, we were piecing together what happened on board that ship. And one of the things you did hear is that ships' VDRs, vessel data recorders, are not as complex. They don't get as much information as airplane black boxes. But what we did get was a good kind of timeline, which we hope to get read to us in the near future, of the exact orders that came out on the bridge. It sounds like, again, the ship's pilots, there were two pilots on board, Chesapeake Bay pilots, who sounded the alarm almost immediately. Once that power went out, they knew they were in trouble. They set in motion their emergency distress signal out. They sent a Mayday out. It started movement on the bridge. It started tugs and Coast Guard vessels heading their way. And the crew seemed to have performed admirably in trying to get a handle on the situation. What we didn't learn, obviously, is what caused the power outage. Matter of fact, the NTSB wouldn't even confirm that there was a power outage at this time.
Yeah, they also said that they hadn't spoken to the pilots yet. And I guess if there's a limit to that data recorder, and I want to get more to that in a moment, but if there's a limit to that, I mean, what kind of questions did they have, would you have for the pilots here?
Well, I think they want to get the feel of the pilots, you know, going on board, what was told to them by the ship's master, was everything in order? What was the events leading up to the loss of power? Was there any indications at all that there was a problem with it? I would want them also to interview the pilots that brought the dolly up to the port. You know, have there been any issues, you know, in docking that vessel, any issues at all in professionalism or maintenance with the ship? And then you want to interview the master. Remember, the crew on board here is Indian. So once you let them go, it's going to be very hard to get them back. So you've got to get all that testimony, all that expert witness information from them while they're here.
Do you think they, I mean, I assume it kind of surprised me that they haven't actually spoken to the pilot yet at this point.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of issues at play. I mean, the pilot would be the one you would want to grab first, because the pilot's not on the vessel anymore. They would have been sent ashore. So you could have grabbed them very early and done that, get their information before, you know, they get exposed to the press and everything else going on in news. You want to get that feeling. The ship's crew is on the ship because they got to maintain the ship. I mean, we still have issues with the ship. If weather comes up, we got to worry about the ship shifting. But they really need to start gathering that information as quickly as they can. Maritime issues are not really the forte of the NTSB. They are much more aviation and road focused. So it's always a challenge when we have maritime issues with the investigation, I think.
That's really interesting. And you know, the biggest change that I think, you know, maybe not everyone realizes is that what you were just saying about, it's not a black box, that's not, doesn't have all the data points that you would get from a commercial airplane if it had crashed. And just the way Jennifer Homendy was describing it is saying it's much more of a snapshot of what's going on the ship at this time. I mean, how much less will they learn because it's a more basic operation?
They have to fill in the pieces. We've seen these investigations when El Faro sunk and a few other vessels we've had incidents with. It's very hard. We don't have all the information. This is something that the U.S. and the International Maritime Organization should really be pushing for better documentation, better technology on board the vessels, so that we can see what happens in case of these emergencies. A lot of vital data we're not going to be able to get. Engine room performance, engine room data, that's the kind of stuff that we need to determine what caused this power failure. Was it mechanical? Was it engineering? Was it electrical? We just don't know. And this is something the NTSB is going to have to do. And then, of course, you have the issue that this is an international ship with international companies. And when you start looking at the elements that are at play here, Singapore flag, Danish company, Indian crew, you know, Japanese classification society, it gets very difficult when you're dealing with all these different entities.
Yeah, all really great points. Sal Mercogliano, great to have you back on The Source with us here tonight.
Thank you for having me.
And now we've talked about the ship here. We're also still learning more about the bridge and its structure, including just moments ago at this press conference. Nehemiah Mabry is a structural engineer, entrepreneur, and an educator who builds bridges for a living. So you are the perfect guest to have here. I just want everyone to listen to a really important moment from that press conference about the structural integrity of this bridge. This is what officials said.
A member fails, that would likely cause a portion of or the entire bridge to collapse. There's no redundancy. The preferred method for building bridges today is that there is redundancy built in, whether that's transmitting loads to another member or some sort of structural redundancy. This bridge did not have redundancy.
What did you make of that, that this bridge didn't have any redundancies on it?
Yes, thanks for having me, Caitlin, and prayers to all affected by this. What this is referring to is the type of structure that existed in this main portion of the bridge, known as a truss. Over these three spans there in the middle, truss is made up of diagonal members that look sort of like a triangular web. And these types of structures are often fracture critical, meaning that if a key component that is either pushing or pulling against another component adjacent or next to it is compromised, it can lead to further compromising or domino effect of the members that are along it. And so around the late 70s or 80s, our coding authorities began to really emphasize the need for structural redundancy. However, today, as was said, it's quite different. But during this time, it was known that truss bridges are very strong. They're among the strongest that you can kind of use in terms of the ability to support vertical weight. However, as we learn things and situations like this happen, the need for structural redundancy became more and more part of our coding lexicon.
But given those coding changes, as you said, came in closer to the 80s. I mean, this is a bridge that was built in the 1970s. So this is something that would have happened before those coding and structuring changes happened.
Yeah, it's hard to tell because there were some lessons we learned in the engineering community in the late 60s that began to change sort of the emphasis on these design practices. And so it was designed right around that time. However, I would say that truss bridges, and in this case, it's a continuous truss that actually shares loads across supports as well. So beyond the fact that the truss itself could potentially be fracture critical, you also have situations where loads are redistributed or attempted to be shared across supports. And so we're talking about different levels, whether it's talking about micro of the actual truss members or even the continuous nature of that portion of the bridge in general. It's always important, of course, to have redundancy. And this is something that has become, towards the latter part of the 20th century, something very, very common now in the bridges that we design.
So, as they're talking about the massive undertaking that is, you know, rebuilding this bridge, when it comes to that, obviously a lot of steps before that. I mean, is that something that would be different in the reconstruction this time around?
Yeah, a couple of things would be different. I mean, obviously the ship sizes, as was mentioned before, have drastically increased since the time of the bridge construction. Not only that, but as we know, there are a number of protective measures even beyond the structure themselves that are put in place, such as dolphins and fenders that are put in place to protect against collapse or impact of this nature. So that being said, I think modern traffic conditions, modern environmental circumstances, you know, are obviously modern shipping circumstances that we have now will all be brought into consideration in the reconstruction and redesign of this bridge.
Yeah. It's a long road ahead. Nehemiah Mabry, thank you for breaking all of that down for us.
Thank you.
And as we mentioned, as part of this has moved on from the recovery phase to the salvage phase, it means divers can no longer navigate these treacherous waters because they are so difficult to recover more victims. We're going to speak to someone who knows these obstacles well in just a moment. He was among the first divers in the water after Florida's Sunshine Skyway Bridge disaster. Also tonight, a reckoning for the chief architect to stop the 2020 election certification. That man you're looking at right there, we'll tell you in a moment.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
Tonight, officials say that they have recovered two victims in the water underneath Baltimore's collapsed bridge. But they were forced to suspend the search because divers can no longer safely operate around the wreckage because there's so much concrete and twisted metal beneath the surface of that water. I want to bring in a veteran diver who knows just how dangerous it can be under a collapsed bridge, because when the Sunshine Skyway over Tampa Bay was hit by a ship and also collapsed in 1980, Bob Rayola was a senior diver with the Florida Department of Transportation, and he helped with that recovery effort. He joins me now. Bob, it's great to have you. And I mean, given Baltimore's harbor has these frigid waters, fast-moving tides, and now these huge pieces of steel and concrete submerged in the water, I mean, how massive is this undertaking?
It's going to be huge. It's going to take quite a while for the divers to cover the entire area as thoroughly as they feel like they need to. Even with the new methods and techniques with side scan sonar, most of the dive recovery is going to be tactile. It's going to be with the divers swimming inch by inch along that concrete and steel debris that's on the bottom.
I imagine it didn't surprise you when they had to call off this search, because right now it's just too dangerous for them to continue searching down there.
No, I completely understand that, and I appreciate the concern for everybody's safety. I know that the conditions up there are significantly worse than what they were down here in Florida on that morning. We had 30 foot of horizontal visibility. The tides and currents are not as significant as they are up in the harbor up in Baltimore. The steel and concrete structure up there still hasn't settled and is probably subject to movements and stuff. I'm sure the divers are hearing creaking and groaning and can't see much out of sight, probably within arm's reach. I'm sure there's a concern about falling concrete, asphalt and steel, sharp edges, all kinds of obstructions that aren't going to be clearly visible. It's completely understandable, and I just wish them the best of luck and encourage them to be cautious. I know that everybody's anxious to resolve the issues and to bring closure to the families and victims, and my heart's out to them. But my heart also goes out to the first responders, the divers, the people topside that are tending them and taking care of them. And I caution them, please be careful. No matter what you do, you're never going to feel like you've done enough, whether it's tonight or tomorrow or next week. It may take quite some time to resolve all of the issues that are going on completely underwater, let alone when they begin the investigation. So I urge caution, and I'm glad that the Coast Guard is taking caution.
Well, and what they're going through, what this is like. And we have a picture from 1980 after that Skyway Bridge collapsed. You're there on the left in this photo. I mean, can you just kind of take us back to what it is like as a diver navigating something where you don't really know fully what you're going into?
That's exceptionally true. It would be difficult for people who haven't been in that situation. I was a combat vet in Vietnam and went through quite a bit of stuff and still couldn't prepare myself for what I was going to see as soon as I hit the water and got underwater. It's something that the divers and the first responders, whether they're divers or not, are going to deal with, not only today and tonight, but they're going to deal with that like I have been for the rest of their lives. Should another issue or a situation like this appear, I'm sure that they're going to feel the same that they do. They will never feel like they've done enough, whether it was last night, today, or tomorrow. They'll always have that little doubt in their mind and thought that they could have done and wish they could have done more.
Bob Raiola, thank you, one, for your service, and two, for your expertise on this and for explaining what this is like to us.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Also tonight, major consequences for one of Donald Trump's alleged co-conspirators for his role, a major one, if not the central one besides Donald Trump, in attempting to overturn the 2020 election. There is breaking news out of California tonight as the attorney who has been called the chief architect of Donald Trump's bid to overturn the 2020 election, a California judge has now just recommended that John Eastman be disbarred. It is a 128-page scathing rebuke where the court found that his, quote, lack of remorse and accountability presents what they say is a significant risk to the public. This is the culmination of a months-long trial that has been going on. But really, bigger picture, it's a major reckoning for another lawyer who tried to keep Trump in power after he lost in 2020. The California Supreme Court will have the final say here, but this ruling will force Eastman's law license into inactive status, which effectively bars him from practicing the law. I'm joined tonight by the chief trial counsel for the State Bar of California, George Cardona, who led the Eastman case. And it's great to have you here. I mean, this is a blistering decision when you read it. Why do you believe a case like this against John Eastman is so important?
I mean, it's important because for a number of reasons. I mean, one, the violations of a lawyer's duties were clear and obvious, as the opinion makes clear. Mr. Eastman lied on repeated occasions, made false statements of fact and law. But second, and what makes the case really unusual is the context in which those violations of an attorney's duties occurred. They were made, as the court found, as part of a conspiracy with his then client, then President Trump, to attempt to delay and obstruct the counting of the electoral votes and delay the peaceful transition to President-elect Joe Biden.
How do you expect the California Supreme Court to rule here?
Well, I mean, the recommendation will go up to them. The opinion lays out in quite some detail the extensive evidence that was presented to support it. My hope would be that when and if it gets to the Supreme Court, that they uphold the recommendation and order the disbarment.
Do you believe that John Eastman violated criminal law with his actions?
You know, that's probably not for me to judge. There is a pending criminal case in Georgia in which he's named. You know, what we alleged were a series of what we believed were false statements, and the court's opinion concludes that on repeated occasions, both in public, to Vice President Pence and Vice President Pence's counsel, and in court filings, Mr. Eastman made false statements. The court also does find, by clear and convincing evidence, which is a somewhat different standard from the criminal standard, that he did engage in a conspiracy with then President Trump to try and obstruct the counting of the electoral votes.
Yeah, George Cardona, it's worth reading in full. Thank you for joining us tonight to talk about this important case.
Thank you for having me.
Also here tonight is CNN's senior legal analyst, Ellie Honig. And Ellie, what do you make of this ruling when you read it?
John Eastman did this to himself, and that becomes very clear when you read this ruling. And it's important to understand what line exactly John Eastman crossed, because a defense lawyer has a duty and really an obligation at times to make aggressive arguments or novel arguments or unusual arguments.
Sure.
What John Eastman did, though, as Mr. Cardona just said, is he time and again, dozens of times laid out in this opinion, gave false information to court, made arguments based on things that he claimed were fact, but that he knew or should have known were false. And that's why he's now had his license suspended.
So what do you make of his statement tonight where he's saying that the process, as they refer to it, that he undertook is the same one taken by lawyers every day and everywhere. It is the essence of what lawyers do.
It's good in theory if that is what he had done, but that's not what he did, right? I mean, we see people make novel legal arguments all the time. I'll give you a recent example. We saw groups of lawyers recently bringing 14th Amendment challenges to try to keep Trump off the ballot. Well, that was untested. They were making aggressive arguments that failed almost uniformly, that were rejected 9-0 by the Supreme Court. But that's not going to get anyone disbarred because they didn't lie. They didn't make up facts. They didn't put things in front of the court that they knew were false. And that's the difference. And Eastman's trying to say he was on the one side of the line, but he clearly crossed it.
Well, and the side that he's now on, I mean, it's Rudy Giuliani, Jeffrey Clark, Jenna Ellis, Sidney Powell, like all of these attorneys who were in Trump's orbit in those final critical few weeks when he was trying to not leave office. I mean, it's kind of remarkable to see the culmination of the big picture of it.
It really is. Look, it's not lawyers' finest day as a profession. Hopefully it will be a lesson to people. But if you tick through it, you have people who are indicted in Fulton County. Most of those lawyers you just named, you have several of them, including Eastman, have been named as co-conspirators, not charged in Jack Smith's case. You have several who have now lost their law licenses. You have people who've been sued civilly. So there's real accountability coming home to roost.
Well, and for John Eastman, you know, some of these attorneys are not actually practicing. He is currently a practicing attorney. And even though he'll appeal this, I have truly zero doubt about it. I mean, he can't practice law right now.
Yeah, not to state the obvious, that's a big deal to lose your law license. This is his life's work. He's been a practicing lawyer for 40 years or so. And not only do you have the humiliation of losing your license, you lose your ability to make a living. So there are real consequences here.
Yeah. What do you think the Supreme Court of California, because this is important. He's not outright disbarred. It's recommendation after a lengthy investigation in which he defended himself in this process. But what do you make of the California Supreme Court, how they handle this?
By the way, he cannot complain that he did not have process. I mean, he had a full hearing. This ruling is exhaustive. I think the California Supreme Court will agree with the ruling that we just saw that just came out. I think they will ultimately disbar him. You know, I read through that ruling as quickly as I could. It's 128 pages. It is nuanced. It is detailed. And it goes through not just one or two or three, dozens of examples where Eastman said dead people voted and underage people voted, just simply false. And I guess he thought he could get away with it. But
I mean, it compares him to, it says that they haven't seen behavior like this since, it cites one of Nixon's henchmen.
Yeah. I haven't been around that long, but in my experience, same here. I mean, it's almost become part of this story that you almost can take for granted. But when you think back to when this was all happening, not just John Eastman, but Jeffrey Clark and Rudy and Sidney Powell, none of this could have happened without them. They were the enablers that took Donald Trump's wild fantasies and gave the legal imprimatur to it and really spurred this whole thing on. So these consequences, I feel sorry for someone in a human sense when they lose their license or when they get indicted or when they get sued, but I just don't feel any sympathy here because they've earned all of this.
Well, I mean, and if someone at home is feeling sorry for him, which I'm not sure many people are for John Eastman, you know, as we were waiting for this to come down, and Caitlin Pollens, you know, my colleague and I were talking about the ramifications of this, I was thinking about what John Eastman said after he turned himself in Georgia, because he's a co-defendant of Trump's there, and whether he ever regretted tying himself to Trump.
Do you still think the election was stolen?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Still?
No question.
Do you regret attaching your name to the former president?
None whatsoever. The president calls and asks for representation. I think every citizen in my position should be willing to stand up for representation.
I mean, when the judge says he has no remorse, he has no regrets either.
The judge cited that. Look, Eastman could have very well said, look, I was trying to do my job as a lawyer. Things got out of control. I regret what happened. I hope I didn't harm anyone. Instead, he's doubling and tripling down.
Yeah. Ellie Honig, thank you for being with us on this major breaking news. Also, speaking of major, it is a red flag to tell lies on a job interview. Obviously, we all know that. But apparently it is not at the new Trump-run Republican National Committee. There's a new question that hires apparently have to get wrong.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. Join me, Philip Nguyen, a scholar of Vietnamese-American culture, and the cast and crew as we discuss the making of this historic series. Subscribe now to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts and stream HBO's The Sympathizer starting April 14th exclusively on Max.
Name, resume, and did you think that the 2020 election was stolen? CNN has learned that that last question is what people who are applying for jobs at the Republican National Committee are being asked by party officials. It sure sounds like a litmus test for the kind of blind loyalty that the National Republican Party has been looking for and really showcasing after purging the committee earlier this month after the chairwoman stepped down. It's all in stark contrast to what that chairwoman, Ronna McDaniel, and the new co-chair, Laura Trump, have been saying when they themselves were asked about the outcome of the 2020 election just this week.
Where I was in 2020 and the quotes that are being taken from a very long time ago, 3.5 years ago, to where I am today, you've got to allow the process to play out. And I think it is fair to say there were concerns then, but no, Biden is the president and we need to move forward.
Is it going to be the position of the RNC in 2024 that the 2020 election was not fairly decided or that it was stolen somehow?
Well, I think we're past that. I think that's in the past.
Joining me now, former deputy assistant to President Biden, who also served as a senior White House communications aide, Jamal Simmons, and also Republican strategist and the former deputy campaign manager for the DeSantis presidential campaign, David Polyansky. I mean, one, I have to note that Ronna McDaniel and Lara Trump both pushed and promoted lies about the election, claiming all of this fraud, which obviously didn't exist. But I mean, as a Republican, are you comfortable with that question being asked of employees?
Well, look, first and foremost, I get Democrats want to talk about 2020 in terms of the election. And I think for Republicans, we need to be talking about 2020 in terms of asking voters if they were better off in 2020 than they are today. That's where the debate needs to be. As it pertains to these specific questions, I don't know. Reading the Washington Post today, it sounds like it was one of a plethora of questions, whether, you know, not just how they felt about the 2020 election to would they be willing to move to Palm Beach? So the question is, was it a litmus test? I don't think it's actually clear on that. And for me, I think you would need to ask potential employees, especially if they're going into the field, how they would respond to that question, probably just as you'd ask a Democrat field operative who was going to Michigan, how they would answer the question about the U.S. position on the Israeli-Gaza conflict. So,
but isn't it a litmus test if you would get asked the question and if your answer is one thing, you don't get hired?
Well, let's see. I don't know if that's the case, and the Washington Post didn't report that.
But why else ask it?
Well, why else would you ask, you know, again, a plethora of questions? You have to be able to go in the field. Make no mistake, if you are applying to go to the RNC right now, you have to be willing to go in and support and defend Donald Trump and try to do everything in your power to get him into the White House. You know that is his position on the issue, and I don't think it's unfair to ask the question. What I hope is the RNC doesn't focus their hiring practices on the answer to that question, but instead hires the best people in the best positions, because we are way far behind our friends on the other side, and we need to catch up, and we don't have time for litmus tests.
It's clearly yes, because it's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. I've seen this multiple times. Every 4 years, the new presidential nominee gets to choose who they want to bring in. They layer over some staff. I've been layered over. I've also been the person who's layered over someone else, right? It's what happens to you when the nominee wins. But what you don't do is do a wholesale purge, kick everybody out, tell everybody, oh, now you get to reapply, and you have to sign up to a conspiracy theory that is demonstrably not true, and most Americans don't either don't believe or don't want to hear about it anymore. And you talk about whether or not we're better off today than we were in 2020. We're absolutely better off than we were in 2020. In 2020, we were in the middle of a pandemic with a president who wanted us to use bleach to get rid of it, get rid of COVID. So the more people focus on what's happening in the future, the better off we're going to be. But this idea of what they're doing at the RNC is absolutely crazy.
I would just push back to say, I think voters feel differently, and that's why it's incumbent upon the RNC, it's incumbent upon the Trump campaign and all Republicans that are trying to win the White House this go around and frankly recapture the Senate and hold the House to talk about that contrast, because voters disagree by a wide margin, whether it's on the economy and inflation to border security to crime and everything in between. For some reason, they have a very romantic view of the first Trump administration back in those days. And unless there's a change of heart, and that's why I think Democrats are trying to change 2020 back to the election, they're in deep trouble.
I guess where I see this is, this isn't a policy issue. It's not like immigration. Sure. You know, every policy issue I could probably say, the two of you probably disagree on. Energy policy, immigration, climate change, all of these issues. This isn't an immigration, this isn't a policy debate. It's a yes or no question, and the answer is no, it wasn't stolen. So why are they asking, you know, these prospective staffers to have to say, because they're going to feel like they have to say yes.
Every person that works on the Trump campaign or in the RNC and goes in the field is going to be asked about election integrity, whether reflecting in the past or certainly as it goes forward into 2024. That's just the reality. I mean, we're talking about it here today. And so my view, my hope is that they are asking that question to see how people answer it. I would think it would be a massive and significant mistake to make hiring decisions based off of their answer.
You know, Caitlin, campaigns are games of addition. right? You have to assemble as many people as possible in order to win. This looks like a game of division. Not only is the president dividing Democrats from Republicans, now he's dividing Republicans from Republicans, because either you have to sign up for the chaos or not. And apparently, if you work for Nikki Haley, you also can't get a job with the Trump campaign or with the RNC. That's the word on the street these days, right? So if that's true, they are taking Republicans out of Donald Trump's win column. That just seems like a recipe for failure.
I mean, it's the ultimate trick question. But anyway, great to have both of you here on set. Thank you for that. Another big question that is being asked, one less controversial. I don't know. Maybe it's actually just as controversial. Should kids be allowed to have smartphones before they are in high school? My next guest says no, and he thinks that smartphones and social media are actually fueling a mental health crisis among children. We'll listen to him make his case right after this. Should kids have access to social media? It seems like a simple question, but it really has dire implications, as the U.S. right now is facing a devastating mental health crisis among its children. This week, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed a bill into law banning children 14 and under from having their own social media accounts. And that's really just the latest in a string of states that are trying to pass laws that restrict young Americans from being on social media. But with youth suicide rates rising, a big question is whether or not it's enough, and what parents should be doing to bring normalcy back into their children's lives in the smartphone era that we now live in. Joining me now is Jonathan Haidt, who is a social psychologist from New York University and also the author of the new book, The Anxious Generation: How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. And it's so great to have you on, because this book is really engaging. And essentially what you're saying is that we went from this era of, you called it play-based childhood, to now it's smartphone-based. Mm-hmm. And the consequences that are so obvious from that.
That's right. So one of the things I try to do in the book is not just say, you know, the sky is falling, look at how bad the mental health stats are. I take a long time in the book to go through, what is childhood? Why do we have it? Why is human childhood so long? And once you see all the things we have to do in childhood, developing our social skills, taking risks, and you see that we were doing that all the way up until the 1990s. Kids were doing that from, you know, 5 million BC until the 1990s. We start reducing that, we're overprotective, but their mental health doesn't plummet until they trade in their flip phones for smartphones. And that all happens between 2010 and 2015. That's the great rewiring, because a flip phone doesn't take up every minute of your life, but once you get a smartphone, it does. And childhood, as we knew it for millions of years, is kind of over.
And you basically, a quote that you said that really stuck out to me, you said, we've overprotected our children in the real world, and we've underprotected them online. You want to see changes here with these companies, not in the sense of cleaning up content and fixing that. Right. You believe it's bigger than that.
That's right. Everyone focuses on the content. The latest data shows that American kids are spending about 5 hours a day on average just on social media. Just social media. You add in all the other stuff, and you're up to 8 to 10 hours a day on their phones and other screen devices. That pushes out just about everything else. Now, there's a lot of efforts to say, well, let's clean it up. Let's you know, if they're going to spend 10 hours a day, let's at least make it not so much suicide content, and let's make it nicer stuff. It's still 10 hours a day. It means they're still sleeping less, they're exercising less, they're seeing their friends much, much less, they're not studying as much, they're distracted all the time. So my point is, we can't possibly make social media safe for middle school kids. It's just absurd. Middle school is where the greatest damage is done, especially to girls. We have to just get it all out. I'm not saying ban phones legally. I'm saying we need a norm. All parents are thinking, like, when's the right age? And they give a phone early because everyone else did. But if we can just say, let's get it all out of middle school. No smartphones till high school. Just give your kid a flip phone or an Apple Watch. That would go a long way.
Which is what you've done with your own kids.
That's right. Well, I didn't know any better when I first gave my son an iPhone in fourth grade. But I have delayed social media. I made it clear to them, no social media of any kind in middle school.
Because you describe these foundational reforms, and one of them is no smartphones before high school, no social media before 16. You think schools should be phone-free and more playtime and independence.
Yep,
I think a lot of parents are like, yes, sure, yeah, I like that. But there's kind of this sense, it seems, of resignation and not, how do you practically implement this?
Yeah, that's been stunning to me. You know, most of my previous writing, there's been some controversy. There've been people saying I'm wrong or I'm stupid. Here, I haven't yet found anyone who's disagreeing with me. Everyone has seized the problem. But there's a pervasive sense of, well, what are you going to do? The genie's out of the bottle. We can't roll it back. We have to roll it back. Our children don't have childhood. They're coming out in terrible shape. Academic performance is down. I mean, we can't just say, well, what are you going to do? The secret, the trick to getting out of this is to recognize that we all hate it. The kids even don't like it. The kids even say they wish these programs were never invented. But they're trapped. And so it's a collective action problem. And if we can coordinate, we can solve it collectively. So it just so if you're a parent and you're listening to this, get on a text thread or talk to the parents of a couple of friends of your kids. If you all delay smartphones or if you all put certain restrictions on, then it's okay. Your kids will go for it. They just don't want to be the only one. So we can escape this if we act collectively.
But do you hear from parents who are actually doing that?
Yes, I do, every day. But my hope is it's so far, it's lone parents who are doing it, and then their kids feel isolated. And then they often feel like they're grateful later. But I want to make it easy for parents to do it today, tomorrow.
Jonathan Haidt, the book is The Anxious Generation. It's fascinating. Everyone should read it. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thanks so much, Caitlin.
And thank you all so much for joining us for this very, very busy hour. Laura Coates Live starts right now.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.